I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Dr. Chris Haynes. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much.
I say Dr. Chris Haynes, you have a doctorate in anthropology.
I do.
Tell me, at what tender age did you take out your doctorate?
I started in my late 50s and finished a bit after I was 60. It took me a few years to do, but doctorates do. They're hard things to do. By the time you've done the research and then worked out what you're going to do and what order you're going to, how you're going to tell the story, how you're going to make the narrative that will make sense to people, it takes a bit of thinking. But anyway.
And tell our listeners what your topic was.
Yes, it was. It was about the joint management of Kakadu National Park. It was and remains a very difficult issue. And the reason it's difficult is because we're dealing with the interdisposition, I suppose, of two quite different people of quite different cultures, and it's very difficult for each to understand the other. And so I found that there were things that worked about it, and there were things that didn't work. Most of them didn't work, So it was a challenging thing to do. There's a little bit more work now done in anthropology about culture contact, but it's a challenging thing in itself also.
The two different cultures being the indigenous culture in that
exactly.
area plus the non-indigenous
yes,
culture.
Exactly.
And you have all yeah. sorts of things, uranium mining, people coming in and wanting to do forestry, people coming in and doing pastoral activities.
Well, there weren't those alien land users like forestry and mining. Sorry, forestry and pastoral things in the national park setting. But Kakadu was notorious because it had the Ranger uranium mine in the middle of it, and that's now been mined out. But there were also quite a number of other uranium prospects around the place, and so that in the early years, in particular, made it very complicated. The management complicated, but as if that wasn't enough, then we're dealing with the way in which the actual park people do their job, and that's a fraught situation.
We'll explore that in a slightly different context before long, because you are the author of a book just published this year, The Bureaucrat and the Man in the Creek Bed, The Work and Influence of John Hunter at Menengreda, 1963 to 1974, published by the Historical Society of the Northern Territory, which I've just finished reading. There's a nice photo of John, I think, on the front.
It is a nice one. It's of him thinking as he's on his way back from a trip out to one of the outstations, one of the small communities out away from Menengreda.
Chris, when you wrote this, you had the PhD behind you.
I did.
And you'd taken what no doubt was an earlier ethnographic interest that you were exposed to, as we'll come to in a moment, followed it into the whole detailed scholarly world of anthropology, and you've written this book with all of that behind you. But tell our listeners this, how did you come to meet and then develop a relationship with the subject of your book, John Hunter?
Yeah, well, I don't suppose we really could have started on a worse way. I was not to know at that time when I went to, as a young, about a 24-year-old, I think, young forester, trying to promote the way in which the Northern Territory Forestry Program was to go on Aboriginal land. Of course, in those days, it wasn't really regarded as Aboriginal land in the way that we treat it now. What I was not to know was that there had been a great deal of bad blood between Hunter, who was the superintendent of the settlement at Menengreda under the direction of the welfare branch, and I was representing a body of people who had never really cooperated with him, and this had been going on for some years. Now, this was 1969. I think the bad feelings had developed 3 or 4 years earlier. So there was in the relatively short period of the history of Menengreda, which itself only started as a settlement in 1957, just in that time, so it was a relatively long period, several years of bad blood. So I turn up and John treated me with not exactly hostility, but polite attention. But that was about all that I got.
At that stage, you're a forester. You haven't become an anthropologist at that point.
I hadn't.
You're 23, 24 years of age.
That's right.
And your wife is with you?
Yes, she was. We lived in Darwin, and I used to. First of all, I was the so-called Aboriginal training officer, and I was supposed to be training Aboriginal people in the way that white people wanted things to be done. That in itself was problematic. But both of us, we also had a young daughter at that point, and so we lived in Darwin. I used to visit Maningrida, and that turned out to be increasingly often.
So remind our listeners how far, particularly if you get in a small plane and fly there or drive there, is it away from Darwin?
It's a long way, and in those days, put it this way, these days you can drive from Darwin to Maningrida when the roads are open in the dry season in about 5 or 6 hours, depending on how reckless you are. In those days, driving to Maningrida probably took about 3 days.
Astonishing, isn't it?
So it's just so we used to, so almost everything was by flying.
The other thing we need to remember, pointing out this to our listeners, back in the days we're talking about, so far as the Aboriginal people are concerned, you're talking about this was Aboriginal land, but they didn't think of it as such then. The Aboriginal Land Rights Act, passed by a Commonwealth in Canberra, hadn't come into place.
That's right.
So there was no land that had been granted, in a sense, back to the Aboriginal people or recognised as theirs. And on top of that, the Northern Territory was a territory administered by the Commonwealth, and it wasn't yet a self-governing province.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah. So far as Aboriginal affairs was concerned, you had a great policy debate in Canberra about how Aboriginal people in this country were to be treated. And I think the word assimilation is often used.
Well, that's true. And forestry, in fact, the reason that forestry got going was because Mr. Hasluck, then Sir Paul Hasluck, was Minister for Territories for a really long period, and he did the hard yards in getting the forestry program going, because he wanted to have industries that Aboriginal people could work in, and forestry seemed to be a natural one, and so he really pushed it, and he pushed it through Cabinet in 59. As a result, the Commonwealth appropriated, the Parliament appropriated money for the program to start. Now, Hasluck's vision was that this would be something that Aboriginal people could do, and it would be a good industry for them to be involved in, together with the sawmilling, which sort of goes with it. He was looking for all sorts of things. Agriculture, poultry,
primary industry
of any kind of primary industry, because that's what they thought at the time. Not just him, but many others thought at the time was an appropriate way of getting Aboriginal people to start getting the hang of the way in which we taught. So that it was really a very colonialist, top-down directed. Program. Hasluck pushed it through. There was a great deal of debate about which department it should be dealt with, or which department should run it. And in the end, it was decided that it was the Forestry and Timber Bureau which should do it, because it was the foresters in Canberra were doubtful that forestry was really all that worthwhile. And if it hadn't been for Hasluck's pushing, then it wouldn't have ever happened.
So it finishes up in a department.
It does.
The forestry department. But there was also other departments dealing with the welfare of Aboriginal people.
That's correct.
And what,
yes.
What was that department?
That's right. Well, that was part of the Northern Territory Administration, that Mr. Haslick was in charge of, or the Minister for Department of Interior, sorry, Department of Territories at that time. And so the Hunter worked in the welfare department, in the welfare branch, run by a man called Harry Geezy. And Harry Geezy was handpicked by Haslick, really, although ministers weren't supposed to do that in the public service. But he promoted Geezy as a person who he thought had the resourcefulness and determination to make the policy that Haslick had devised to stick. Now, the problem that happened when we had two different departments is that the foresters didn't listen. And it was only a matter of about a year before the two lots fell out with each other at the top level. And this schism never really seemed to get repaired. And that schism certainly was perpetuated on the ground at Maningrida.
I suppose it's not unfair to say this was then, and probably still is in many ways, in a context where not everybody agreed about the place, the rights, the entitlements of traditional owners to their country and their rights to self-determination.
No, well, that was something that people like Professor Stanner were talking about. Stanner was redoubtably an eminent, the preeminent anthropologist of that time, and is a person whose work I still regard as being preeminent among anthropologists in Australia. And he was saying that it was a quote that I've often used, to saying that suppose that the Aboriginal people wanted to change, the question that really also came next was, how did they know how to? They had to know how to do it, and they didn't. So anyway, that was certainly a time when the idea of land rights and so on was starting to bubble up. People like Stanner gradually gained traction, and ultimately the federal government, after the 1967 referendum, the federal government felt that it had to do much more than it had been doing to promote what Aboriginal people did and wanted, and to listen to them properly.
Listeners will also find it helpful to know that before the Mabo, there was a case run by Aboriginal people claiming their traditional land and saying their rights were recognised by Australian law. It's known colloquially as the Gove land rights case.
That's right.
And it failed before a single judge. The Mabo decision many years later effectively reversed the decision of that case. But people like Stanner were witnesses from memory.
That's right. He was.
And a lot of the other leading anthropologists of the day were there to explain Aboriginal culture, how people have rights to land, and how different clans and estates are managed by them. And as I said earlier, the Aboriginal Land Rights Act in 1976 eventually recognised a lot of that, came up with a formula for granting land to Aboriginal people that they were traditionally owners of. But just come to Maningrida for a moment. A lot of people will know the name. It's one of the prettiest names for a place. But it wasn't always that the town came, or earlier than that, the settlement that it became, was it?
No. It was just a series of springs. Maningkaira was the name of the little waterhole and the spring on which the traditional owners, the clan owners of that land, really clustered around most of the time. They and the people who were intermarried with them. Dukuruji is the name of the clan, and they were dwellers there. And then what happened was that patrol officers gradually started to take a bit more interest in the place, and there were a couple of reasons why the government eventually, Mr. Geezy, in fact Harry Geezy, decided that they had to make a permanent presence there. And the first reason, probably most important reason, was that the health situation was really very bad. Leprosy was rife, and another disease called yaws, which we don't hear about much these days, were both quite prevalent. and it was too hard to operate nursing attention from the missions that were to the east and the west of Maningrida. So it was decided that that would be a place where there should be a nurse who could treat leprosy in Yours, and other things as well, of course. So that was one reason. The other reason was that there was a great deal of tension caused by the younger Aboriginal men in particular walking into Darwin. They thought nothing of walking into Darwin. It took them a few days, but they were able to do it faster than I could. And they walked into Darwin and then camped on the fringes, of became fringe dwellers. And one of the early patrol officers, Sid Kyle Little, said their situation was terrible. You know, they were desperately poor. There was no welfare for them. There was no resources on the land that they were camped at. And so they tended to beg. Some of them got employment, but that meant that those employed shared with their families who were around, or people they knew. And so it was really the time when the government, you know, Geezy in particular, decided that they should go to Maningrida and set up a station. The idea was that the people from all the hinterlands around Maningrida would come in, trade and get health services, and then go back to their country. That didn't happen. They stayed, and they arranged themselves in the way that a ceremonial ground would be. And so what also happened was that the traditional owners, the Dukuruchi people I mentioned, the clan, they were dominated by the others who came in, and that caused a great deal of tension and friction. And Hunter was very, very aware of that when he got there in 1963.
So John Hunter arrives in 63. I have to tell the listeners, and Chris and I talked about this earlier, this story in many ways is like a Greek tragedy to me.
Yeah, it is.
Because in 1993, in December, John Hunter walked into a dam down near Bega and drowned.
Yeah.
It's a very, very sad story. And in the epilogue to your book, you say, Chris, and I'll quote it because it's quite moving, "For all the influence he had on me and hundreds of others, most of them Aboriginal, his life meant so much more than that. First, he showed that compassion for the underdog, fundamental courage and humanity in public service is worthwhile. Second, he changed the course of the history of Maningrida and its Aboriginal people. Not only Maningrida, but also the implementation of public policy throughout remote Aboriginal Australia. In doing so, he trod on toes, changed the trajectories of lives, and in the end, hurt himself irreparably." It's such a moving statement about this man. You got to know him well, and you started to touch on how that happened. You're a young forester. He's what, 5 or so years older than you?
6, I think.
Six years. You're a relatively young man. How old was he when he gets up there? Just in his late 20s?
Yes, he was only 26, I think. Something like that. But, you know, that age gap, when I first met him and after that, he had the gravitas of someone a generation older than me. I just knew nothing, and he seemed to know everything, and not just about the Aboriginal community that was there, but just sort of had that, like I said, gravitas and the world, a world view that was of a very mature man. And that had been honed through all the rough and tumble that he'd been through already in just those few years.
Now, he grew up in New South Wales, out near Bega, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, he grew up in a place called Wappingi. It's a little lovely area just to the north of Bega.
And what did the family do there?
They were oyster farmers.
Oyster farmers?
Oyster farmers.
And was there a local Aboriginal population when he was younger? He was.
Yes, they were. The Koori people. I can't remember the language name there, but they used to come and go past there. And it seemed to me as though, from what one of John's relatives has told me, that the Hunter family were much more sympathetic to the plight of Aboriginal people in the south coast of New South Wales than many others around the place. There was a lot of hostility in those times. So I suspect that might have been one of the things that that caused him to decide he would like to become a patrol officer in the Northern Territory, which he did. He qualified at the school in Bega, went to Bega High School.
So he goes to Bega High School, he finishes, does he matriculate for university?
He matriculated, he could have gone to university.
And
which is very unusual for those days, for rural kids. Very unusual.
Early 60s. So how does he make the move and who gives him a job?
Well, he applied to be a clerk in the Commonwealth Government in the welfare branch in Darwin. And he worked as a clerk, and then it gave him probably a bit of an inside running, and then he applied for and was promoted, really just translated. It was something like £305 a year or something like that. This is in 1957.
So there we are, 1957, you know, it's hardly 10 years after the Second War.
Mm.
Darwin, of course, got bombed during the war. It was pretty much an outpost, in a sense, at the best of times then.
Yeah.
He turns up there, the Commonwealth Administrator, he's got a job as a young clerk. He's obviously got plans and a social conscience to start out with. Do we have any idea where that comes from?
Well, I think the social conscience probably came from witnessing the way in which some of the broader population, English-speaking, white Australian population around his country, around Bega, were treating Aboriginal people, because it was really appalling, and it's been well documented by Charles Riley and a number of other people. I don't know, but I suspect that's what caused
knowing the man that you got to know.
Yes.
So he comes to Darwin and he thinks, right, he's got a plan, and he moves into the welfare.
That's right.
Branch.
Yeah.
So how does he get to Manangreta, and when he does, what's his job, and how many people are up there?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing too, because he first of all, as the patrol officers were, they were sent on patrol, and it meant that they were doing a lot of driving. Even by camel and so on, down around Alice Springs. He spent his first few years as a patrol officer down around Alice Springs. He'd been did a little stint as the superintendent, which meant the boss man, at a settlement called Arionga, which is fairly small, close to Alice Springs. And then he got the call up to go to Manangreta, and he was only, I think, around 26 or so, very young, very young. And he said to me afterwards, it really didn't go well. I felt like I failed. I was too young. I made a mess of it.
When he first went to Manangreta.
When he first went to Manangreta. But he lasted there about a year, or a bit more than a year.
What do you think, looking back, the bosses in his branch in Darwin saw in the 26-year-old that had them send him off there? Was there no one else, or did they actually see that he was going to be good at this?
Well, this has to be seen in the context of that period too, because this is after the war, and the demand for people to do things, anyone who could stand up, anyone on two legs, especially young men, were just in such high demand. And Giese, I have to say, Giese was very fussy about the selecting the people that he wanted. So there weren't very many people chosen to be patrol officers, and he was just one of a small cadre in that year, 1957. when he went to the Australian School of Pacific Administration, which taught them a bit of anthropology, a bit of geography, a bit of agriculture.
I'm really fascinated by that attempt to acculturate people who needed it, going to work with Aboriginal people. Whose dream was that course and that accreditation?
Well, it probably a combination of people, but Harry Giese was certainly very important in it. It was really, I suppose, Elkin decided that Professor Elkin, who was Professor of Anthropology at Sydney University, who had the running of the teaching of anthropology for the patrol officers who went to New Guinea, and at that point, probably the lion's share of those desirable people, if we could call them that, were being sent to New Guinea. That was the mainstream, where Australia was very aware of its responsibilities, Hasluck in particular, very aware of the responsibilities Australia had.
We were the colonial power in PNG.
Exactly.
And that's interesting. So the training course for that, they're equating the Northern Territory a little bit.
It was adapted to suit the conditions of the Northern Territory.
There were very few people in those days, I'm guessing, who were steeped in anthropology. You've mentioned Stanley, you've mentioned Elkin, Radcliffe Brown in an earlier point, but there were others coming into the field, even Americans coming here to discover the anthropology of Aboriginal Australia.
That's true. Well, at that point, yes, it was a really quite rare discipline. Elkin, in a way, had the monopoly of the teaching of anthropology in Australia until Ron and Catherine Burnt set up here over in WA. They were South Australians and came here to the University of WA. But Elkin seems to me to have been very dominant, many anthropologists have said that. And Stanner was much more independent in the way he looked at anthropology, and I'm not quite sure of the exact friction between them, but there certainly was some. Yeah.
Well, when you get into these social sciences, my experience tells me that people can have strong views, Chris.
Certainly.
And in fact, that's really, as I'm seeing the book, as I read through it, it's taking me through a whole lot of experiences I've been through from the mid-90s to recent times. What happened, this young man who's interested, he's been through the course, he's been exposed to Elkin's thinking, he knows something about the anthropology of the traditional owners in the area. Broadly speaking, what do we know he knew, or more importantly probably, having got to Maningrida, having spent 12 months there and eventually coming back, doesn't he?
He got too hard. I don't know if the separation, or you know, his change of direction was mutually agreed, or whether Giese decided that he'd had enough of him and that he had to move on. But it was only a year or a bit more before he was back again, and then he was back again for a really long time.
So what does he then learn? I mean, you've looked at this and you write about it in the book, and you've alluded to it as well. Like, you've got the traditional owners for the what we'll call the country of Maningrida.
Yeah.
The town, as we know it, was created, settlement, township, etc. And then these other people from outlying areas with their own traditional interests come to town. And you say they set up like in a ceremonial formation, and I've seen that, for example, when people came in from the Pilbara to Roebourne.
Yep.
Like they each had their part of the quadrangle.
Exactly.
And almost had their signs up. This is our country here.
Exactly, yeah.
But he has to understand what's going on here. Presumably he does.
Yeah, he does. It didn't take him very long to fathom it out. He had things worked out, and the reason for that is because he talked to the people. Interestingly enough, there'd been, because of those people who had, as young men, gone into Darwin, there were a number of people who, younger ones, who could speak English reasonably well. Certainly there could be intelligent. At that time, most of the older men and women were totally devoid of any capacity to speak English, even though they spoke, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 languages.
It's a little known fact, isn't it?
It is.
Aboriginal people speak all these different, sometimes related languages, and had little or no English, you're saying, in those upper generations.
That's right.
And so he arrives there, he can talk to the younger blokes, he's learning about how things work.
Yeah.
He's still a younger bloke, this is a bit I can't get over, but he's got a very decided personality. Tell us about what you think. If we turned up there and met the early 30s Hunter, what sort of guy we would have seen? Would he gregariously greet us and give us a big hug and welcome us?
No. No. He used to frustrate all of the visitors. There was because Maningrida was something of a show place. Harry Giese called it the Jewel of the North, and he wanted all sorts of people there to go to be the sort of proving ground, the show place for the assimilation policy. It was assimilation policy in practice, and so all sorts of people wanted to go there, and Giese himself went several times a year, and unless they were really important and had made a previous appointment, then Hunter was likely not to be found. He saw his job as being with the people and listening to the people, and that's where his priorities lay.
It's a very convenient time just to go back to, and our listeners are probably saying, Michael, you've introduced Chris and you've said the book's called The Bureaucrat and the Man in the Creek Bed. What's the significance of the title?
Yeah, it's a quote from another patrol officer, another quite famous patrol officer, Bill Harney. Anyone who knows the Territory knows the name Bill Harney. And
Ted Egan.
And Ted Egan, who's still alive. Bill Harney, and Ted Egan, by the way, wrote quite big reports on Maningrida, but to go to Bill Harney said, if you really want to know what the people think, You've got to camp. You don't camp with the bosses in the station house, in the homestead. You've got to go down in the creek and sit in the creek. And he said, then people will trust you. And I thought that was very apt, because there was Hunter simultaneously being a bureaucrat, doing all the jobs that he was supposed to be doing. And it was an enormous bureaucratic load, huge amount of reporting and so forth. And at the same time, getting out and being with the people in the creek bed.
And I'm just left, as I am in so many of these cases, with a belief that the reason people like John Hunter have gone there was to help the people, in a sense, not to help the bureaucrats have successful careers or whatever. So what did his day job, in that sense, require? What, as a superintendent, what did he have to prepare reports about?
Well, he had to do, well, there are things like all this infrastructure that was being built, and there was being more and more and more of it. And so there were builders coming in, you know, the likes of carpenters, plumbers, electricians, the people that are needed to make things happen. A quite significant housing program for the people of the different agencies, forestry included, and fisheries and so forth. And they were coming and going. Many of those people had stayed for maybe a few months, or else they might be just there for a week, depending on what had to be done. So he was trying to liaise with all of those people. He had liaison with the health department, who were busily trying to deal with these terrible diseases and other health issues. And the schooling, education was a big part of things. So this huge amount of liaison. But as well as that, he was required to do a certain amount of reporting about who the people were there, which Aboriginal people were there. And so that meant doing a census a couple of times a year, going around. And that's a job he did himself. He didn't delegate it, because he wanted to be with the people in the various little camps. And at that time, in the early days, Aboriginal people were living in mostly around the fire and so on in the dry season. And in the winter, in the wet season, they built humpies, I suppose you could call them. Dar, they're called in Guningu. And they're traditional houses. They're absolutely beautiful structures, by the way.
Now, the blackfellas up there, as people at the top end of Australia right across will refer to themselves. I had a name for the whitefellas, though.
Yeah, they're called Ballinder.
Now, where did that come from?
I believe it's the most authoritative source is that it's an adopted Macassan word, which was referring to Belanca, or I believe a Dutch word, through from Dutch, and the Macassan referred to the white Dutch people as Belanca or Ballinder, how it became corrupted.
Isn't it wonderful? It's another reminder about how the top of Australia is connected with the rest of the world.
It certainly was. Certainly was.
Back to John Hunter. Listeners will be wanting me then to say, well, is there some significant other person in his life at this stage?
No, he was a single bloke, there was a certain amount of dark muttering about the fact that about speculating that he was gay, but he wasn't. He was a very shy guy, and it wasn't until he left Maningrida that he got to know the love of his life, Anita Campbell, who was another anthropologist, one of the early anthropologists, who worked incidentally for John Toohey as his research officer, research anthropologist. He and Anita, although she was a bit older than he was, they just hit it off, and they were just lovers, I think, from the time when they first got to know each other and so on. So, but at the time at Maningrida, no, he was on his own. He worked day and night, and which is what the people said.
When we make the movie of this story, Chris, we've got the love interests worked into it, which is very important for the movie plot. And all good movies have white hats and black hats, and I've read your tribute from the end of the epilogue to your book about John, and he'll be wearing a big white hat. But there are people who are wearing black hats here. European people.
Yeah.
Who are they?
Yeah. Well. Most of the people who went there were there because of the purpose that because of their job.
Well, it included you in the first instance.
It did include me in the first place, the fisheries people were interested in fisheries, and the forestry people are interested in forestry, and the builders are interested in getting their job done as best they could, and so on. But many of them had no interest in Aboriginal people, and because of the strangeness in which they found themselves, they're really, in many cases, the creation of this sort of almost white, self-imposed white ghetto. I think I referred to it as that in the book. You know, it was a ghetto, a self-imposed hardship post. The discourse among those people was, generally speaking, hostile, because they just simply, it just comes out of ignorance. They did not understand what Aboriginal people were doing. They often described them as lazy, indifferent, rude, incommunicative.
And had no ethnographic training at all.
No, and some of them were interested in the diacritics, the things that the manifestations of culture, like the lovely artwork which was made then and still is reproduced. Sometimes on bark, mostly on bark painting, but also on boat poles and all those sort of things. But that was about as far as it went. And then there was also resentment, because increasingly there were Aboriginal people were showing their hostility back about these Ballinders just treating the country as if it was open slather and they could go wherever they liked. And
so this becomes the big contest in the book. I mean, the book mirrors this growing awareness that Aboriginal people have rights and they need to be respected. It's not an assimilation policy. We're not just there to be a colonial authority. You've mentioned the 1967 referendum, an important step which widens the perspective of Australians. You get the 76 Land Rights Act coming into place. And a big thing that happens, 1972, the Whitlam government gets elected with a radically different approach to this topic. Tell us what happens then.
Yeah, well, that was crucial. The election of the Whitlam government was just so important, not only in terms of its sort of macro policy levels, but in places like Maningrida. It enabled in remote parts of Australia, it really started to foster the return of people back to their own country, whereas previously they'd not exactly been herded into settlements, but where the resources that were the state's resources were all directed towards the fostering of the settlement, the building programs, the forestry, the sawmilling and fisheries and so forth. And the things that by that stage Aboriginal people were starting to become very disillusioned with the way in which the assimilation policy was bullying them around. And of course, you know, as Harry Giese has said in his defence, that there was never any kind of marshalling of people into the settlement, but that's where the resources were, and so that's why they went. And interestingly, before the Whitlam government, as a matter of fact, some of the Aboriginal people had started to return to their own home country, and Hunter was skillful enough to be able to give them the, or to con Giese, I suppose you'd say, persuade Giese, that it was worthwhile to allow them. And there was a group of people of a language called Gunadpa to the southeast of Maningrida who decided that they would establish a market garden alongside a very very good water supply at Billabong called Gotchindinjara, which enabled them to grow bananas and watermelons and all sorts of things that could be exported. So that appealed to Harry Giese, and Hunter was clever enough to be able to persuade that resource.
Some people will know it as a homelands movement or the outstations movement, that people going back to their, in that sense, their own country.
That's right.
And then the whole self-determination ethic, yes, starts to kick in.
That's right. Yes, well, I'd got away from your question, but these homelands movements were well underway before the change of government. It's interesting to speculate about what it would have been like if the McMahon government had been returned. I rather suspect that it would have still continued, but anyway, when Whitlam and his government came into place, they fostered it, and Hunter took the bit between the teeth, and did everything he could to accelerate what those people wanted to do.
Just on the politics of it, it does seem to me to have been largely bipartisan towards the end as it developed. It was the Fraser Liberal government that passed the 1976 Land Rights Act in the end.
It did.
Things are happening, but there's some lovely stories in it. People like Dr. Nugget Coombs appears. I once had an office next to Nugget's in Canberra. That was one of the delights of my life. But there's a point at which there's a sit-down or a standoff, I'm not sure how you describe it in the book now, where the senior men at Maningrida, in their formation, decide to let the authorities in Darwin know what's going on. And no doubt John Hunter is seen as some sort of evil person behind what's going on by the authorities there. What happened and what was going on at that point?
Yeah, well, what had happened is that the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, which had then become the authority that had taken over from the welfare branch of the Northern Territory Administration, decided that Hunter had had enough time at Maningrida and they gave him a job as a senior project officer in Darwin. It wasn't very long before the person who succeeded him was really totally unprepared for filling the shoes of someone who had been there for 10 years and who was so devoted to the cause that we've been talking about. And so they just came in and started to talk to Hunter, and he talked to, he referred them on to other people in Darwin. So the Darwin people started to understand that things weren't working out. And ultimately they wrote a really quite stinking letter, actually. The council wrote a stinking letter.
The Maningrida Council.
Complaining about this fellow. The department said, look, okay, you can have another man by the name of John Wilders, who had been a deputy to Hunter. He can come back, but he's not available just yet. So Hunter was sent back in the interim. And
tell them about the machinations.
Well, there could be, you know, this is just a matter of happenstance, but I bumped into, I was going out to Maningrida for the week, you know, for a longer period than usual, because I wanted to be talking to the senior people about fire. And there's John Hunter sitting at the Canellans Airport hangar. And we talked on the way out to Maningrida. And what had happened was that suddenly we became aware, both of us in our different, through our different channels, had become aware that Prime Minister Whitlam and senior ministers were coming out to Maningrida on the following Sunday. And so John said, well, we're going to have a meeting with the council and the Prime Minister and his ministers. And he coached them. There's no doubt about that. He coached them about what to say. And what they said was, this place is just being overrun by the Ballanders, by the white people, and we want the pace of development to slow. We just can't handle the pace of change that's being thrust upon us. And Whitlam took that on and said, well, write to me about it, and they did. But then Hunter had a meeting with the... I'm ahead of myself. Hunter, on the following Monday, the next day, just went to the called a staff meeting, and stood down seven, I think it was, people, and said, "Your service is no longer required. Go home and prepare your inventories to move somewhere else."
So basically, sacked a whole bunch of the European people working there.
These days. You know, now we talk about natural justice and so on, and the right to be heard. That is such that you wouldn't get away with it. So but that's what he did.
This is basically a demonstration that the Maningrida Council, the Aboriginal people there, populating that, were making decisions for themselves. That's the way it appears on one view of things.
Well, he coached them about how to. He said, "You've told me endlessly. You've told me endlessly these stories. You've got to tell. Here's the most important person in the country, coming out in the government. You've got to tell him." And he said, "Well, of course, they're shy people. Mm. Their language skills are not really great." And I tell the story about what he was recounting to me afterwards, when a guy who was a really great friend of mine, Ray Munyal, a Jinang man. He got up and he said that message. He just said there we can't cope with the pace of change. And anyway, the so going to the next day, There are these people who have been stood down. Of course, the word got around in no time. I was there with the forestry group, and I tried to settle them down, and I said, well, we'll keep on going, but we'll be conservative. And anyway, very quickly, the message got into Darwin, and Darwin recalled Hunter, and they said, you've got to come back into Maningrida for consultations, which is basically saying you're sacked.
He finishes up going bush.
Well, he did, but it just is a strange sort of part of what was happening. He and a woman who had been helping with the Maningrida Council, developing the council, a Philippine woman by the name of Leah Pinder, she and John came to our house in Alawa, because I'd gone back to Darwin in this time too, and they had a meeting in our house, and they strategized, and I'm as a probably by then about a 26-year-old or something, no, a bit older than that. I was about 28, and I'm just listening agog to how they're going. And anyway, they said, well, the men can come in and get you back. And he said, oh no, that won't work, because they'll call me and then they'll compromise. And I said, that won't do any good. And then he goes, I know, I'll go bush. And he had a job to do at Gumadea, which is out in Arnhem Land. And he went and he wasn't able to be contacted. And then Leah got in touch with some of the Aboriginal men out at Maningrida and just said, look, you know, do you want to get John Hunter back? Yes, we do. So they organised they chartered a DC-3, and they turned up and had a meeting, and then they just went down to the following day, went to the director of Aboriginal Affairs, Creed Lovegrove's office, and they just sat there and they just said, we're not going until we get John Hunter back.
There's a wonderful couple of lines in the book which will feature with a wonderful cameo of whoever plays Gough Whitlam and the smaller guy who plays Nugget Keynes. Tell our listeners what happened.
I'm not quite sure about that connection. Sorry.
Well, I recall that Hunter had to go back and the PM had something to do with it.
There were a number of parallel things going on. But of course, you know, the bureaucracy, they're caught halfway down the wicket, in cricket terminology.
Yes.
You know, they didn't know whether to go forward and follow policy or whether to go back and keep things in an orderly way and respect the rights of those people who'd been stood down and so forth. So they locally reversed it, and then that's when the people came in and had the sit-in in Creed Lovegrove's office, and there was a whole lot of argy-bargy going up and down. In the meantime, a number of people who were very well connected to Nugget Coombs, and Coombs was connected, very very well connected to Whitlam, so they did a bit of legwork down in Canberra, and Whitlam said, okay, well, you've got to take him back. So there was a compromise which said, you'll get John Hunter back for a while until we get John Wilders to come out. But John said it was thrilling, because it gave the Aboriginal people a win that they so deserved. That's really what he said. You know, just, I can still remember the passion with which he said it. He did an ABC podcast at the time. It wasn't called a podcast then, but a program, an ABC program. And he said they were just so in need of a win. And he said that gave them the win that they needed.
And when you look back, was John right? Was what happened then emblematic of what the future was going to hold for them?
Well, the from the Prime Minister down, they said, well, we're going to listen to you. If this is self-determination and if you want to run your own affairs, then we will let you do that. And there's a whole history to that. That took some months, but ultimately, the Aboriginal people chose to run things. So the council ran and appointed a chief executive, you'd call it these days, to be their person to run things, and the department was reduced to an auditing function, and in a sort of way, it was proto-neoliberalism. You know, the people these days talk about neoliberalism as a bad thing, and I think they're generally right. But at that stage, it was really government not abdicating, but just saying, all right, we'll stand back and we'll make sure that you're not wasting money. We've got the taxpayers to be mindful of. And by this stage, the Whitlam government had been dismissed. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of stuff going on.
50 years ago?
At a macro, and, yes, 50 years ago. And at a macro and micro level, these two things are feeding off each other in many ways.
And providing the backdrop or the helping to create the tensions through all of this, what you described earlier, the top-down controls and trying to develop the assimilationist problem and trying to do some good things, no doubt, like providing jobs for Aboriginal people in the area. You've got both these fisheries projects you've made reference to and the forestry projects. But did they ever work?
Well, the forestry project's another story. And I tried not to write too much about that, excepting to the extent that it annoyed the heck out of Hunter. You know, there was a number of things that the foresters, this is my bosses, were doing that annoyed him. Or not just annoyed him, I mean, he just really thought they were absolutely, fundamentally, utterly wrong. One was they built a sawmill that was totally out of scale and quite inappropriate, and which very quickly chewed through the available resources. Anyway, so that was one thing. They would not listen to what the Aboriginal people want. And moreover, the sawmill was producing timber to export it to Darwin when there was a crying need for timber for housing locally. So that caused huge tension.
Sending our wood somewhere else.
Yeah. And then out in the bush, there's another story.
Yes.
Another story that I got very closely involved in because, you know, my bosses thought, look, all we've got to do is to stop fires. And that's really telling Aboriginal people to do something which is a fundamental part of their culture.
Should we remind listeners about this? The use of fire, in particularly in that part of Australia right across, is a significant...
Well, the whole of Australia, there have been now books written about this, you know, about the flaming continent and how Aboriginal people manage the whole of Australia by appropriate management of fire. And it varied according to where you were and what the climate was, etc. But and the scale of things. But around Maningrida, though, they had a very deliberative way of doing things. And ultimately, I started to look into that. That's another story again about... How they used fire, but at that time, my department was just trying to stop fire altogether, and there are problems with this because when you do that, the litter under the forest canopy, this is all to do with a tree called Northern Cypress Pine. It's related to the Rottnest Island Pine here, Calitris, And so it would regenerate all right in patches, but it would also, there'd be all this grass and litter, and you'd finish up with about a metre deep of litter, and then if a fire got into it, well, it just caused all manner of havoc. And so it just wasn't working, and ultimately I was, this is virtually what turned the hostility that Hunter had shown towards me into one of gradually increasing friendship. He took me down to one of the outstations, and he he said, I wouldn't tell them not to light fires if I were you. And I said, no, I have no intention of doing that. But what I said was, look, in forestry, what we're trying to do is to find a way where we can get cypress pine regenerating in a way that lets you still use your fires. Anyway, a bit later in the day, a good friend of mine, Graham Mackay, was down there at this outstation, and he was studying a language called Remberinger at the time. And they said, oh yeah, the forestry man came down and told us not to light fires, which I didn't. And but we're going to anyway, because we always did. So that was really a great point of tension. And so for the numbers of reasons, the program that we were involved in, and I haven't mentioned either the fact that we'd been, because we didn't ever consult with people, I was trying to do it, but the program was devised in a way that wasn't consultative, and we were bulldozing things like what we now call sacred sites.
I couldn't believe that when I read that in your book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's again, something emblematic of a cultural disjunction.
Yeah, no appreciation. Absolutely. Absolutely. It was, but it was, we've got to say, well, it was back 50 years ago. And these days now, people, most Australians understand sacred sites, even if they don't necessarily believe in them. But they know they exist. And there are also ceremony grounds, which are a different thing again.
Yes.
And it was just really embarrassing. And I was having to go and apologise to people. It was very difficult. And meantime, there was tension between me and my bosses. And ultimately, I just had to walk away. I couldn't take it anymore.
Chris, in a similar way, we're getting towards the end of not just your career there, but the podcast. But in the middle of all of this, memory tells me that, towards the end of all of this, my memory's telling me Cyclone Tracy came through. Did that have some effect on...
Yes, I think it did. It's maybe I've under-recognised that in the book, but what happened before Cyclone Tracy is that the Manangaroo Council got so fed up with what the government was planning to do in the wake of the Woodward Report. The Woodward Report had recommended that forestry be allowed to continue in the way that it had, and they were so fed up with that that they said, well, look, it's a good deal of argy-bargy back and forth, but they just said, look, no, we're not going to have the government forestry anymore, and they kicked them and us out. And then Cyclone Tracy occurred a couple of months later. I think I'm talking about October 74, and then Cyclone Tracy was in December 74. And just after Christmas, the forestry people just came and loaded all their equipment on the barge and went away.
Cyclone Tracy sort of blew everything away.
Well, they said they needed there were big D7 bulldozers. You know, D7's a big bulldozer.
Putting them on a barge and taking them back to Darwin.
Put them on the barge and sent them back to Darwin.
My goodness.
So that was really the effect. But Cyclone Tracy did disrupt a whole lot of stuff. But by then, I think the forestry program was cactus. You know, it was over. And if it hadn't been over then, it was going to be death by a thousand cuts anyway.
So the forestry program is very much a strand that's woven through your book. It sets up how you've got the traditional people increasingly want self-determination, make their own decisions, deal with people who want to be visitors to their country and not just intruders, and the role really that John Hunter plays in all of this. We've mentioned at the outset the untimely death of John. When you look back, just tell our listeners why John was such a significant figure for you and in all of the contexts that we're talking about today.
Yeah, well, I think he was, to answer the first part about me, on that trip to the outstation Guyun is really the time when we really started to talk, as it were, with one language. we held a discourse from then on, which was about trying to do the right thing by the Aboriginal people. Oh, by that stage, having been, I might say, a successful forester in junior forester in Mount Gambier, growing pine trees perfectly well, but by that stage, I just thought I'm here because of my interest in Aboriginal people, and so that's the in a sort of personal way. We then became really very good friends and spent a lot of time together and enjoyed each other company, other's company very much. But I wanted to in the book, I wanted to not make it so idiosyncratic. And I did spend a lot of time looking at the files to, as it were, get a picture of as objectively as I could. And I think everything I've said can be verified from looking at the files or other the other sources that I've put in. But here, I also interviewed other people, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, to get a sense of what they thought of this guy and how important he was, and his determination and steadfastness in working with in those difficult situations. But he just knew what he was there for, and that's what he wanted to do, and to do the right thing by them. The fact that when he dismissed those people and so on, that caused a lot of emotional energy to be expended, as you can imagine. He went into an office job after that with field work injected into it. But his heart wasn't in it. I think the Maningrida was the love of his life, ultimately he got so disappointed with the Department for Aboriginal Affairs and the way it was doing things that he decided to leave and to go back to his family's oyster farm, oyster leases.
And it comes, as I say, to the Greek tragedy end in the end of it. John, it's John Hunter's story that you've written about Chris is something. I congratulate you on the book.
Thank you.
I think a lot of people, particularly those who worked in have to do with Aboriginal Australia and Aboriginal people reading this about John Hunter, will all be able to relate to it because it's a significant part of Australia's history.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I wrote it really because so much is written about, you know, the people. Well, Nugget Coombs has been well biographed, and Tim Rouse has done a great job in talking about the macro histories of Aboriginal Australia. But this is a case of where a person who was would be otherwise unrecognised, and he was a mighty bloke, and I didn't want to die before seeing it recorded.
It's beautiful. Thanks for joining me and talking about it.
Thanks, Michael.